Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this FreeCP 120. Yes, hello. And welcome indeed. I am back from my travels. America was excellent. As always, I spent a fascinating week in New Hampshire exploring the Free State Project, amongst other things, and the liberty / freedom scene in general. You can look forward to some excellent conversations from that trip. Plus, I spent some days in Colorado Springs at the leadership program of the Rockies retreat, from which today's interview comes. Before I introduce our guest, a little about the leadership program. From their blurb on their website, it says it's America's premier institute to develop, strengthen, train, and equip emerging leaders to reach new heights in public policy and the political process. LPR identifies and brings together emerging leaders from the legal, economic, business, political, nonprofit, and civic professions to learn how visionary, principle-centered leadership can positively impact their community. Yes, that I would agree with that. My anecdotal explanation of the event, what I saw at least, this was a weekend retreat, part of a 9-month leadership program that, from what I can tell, teaches students of all ages, from 18 up to 80 and beyond, and from all walks of life, not just the political sphere, teaches the essence of America's founding principles, or at least what I know of them. You get to tap into people that really vigorously want to uphold the ideas of individualism, free market capitalism, liberty, and freedom. What's not to love? I found it hugely interesting and invigorating being there. Lots of great speakers at the event, including today's guest, Daniel Hannan. Now, Daniel's a British writer, journalist, and politician. If you're a Brit, you may know him as one of the founders of the Vote Leave campaign. Obviously, one of the organisations that successfully campaigned during our Brexit referendum. You may know him from his best-selling books. Inventing Freedom is the latest and well-liked. If you're an internet user, you may have seen one or other of the clips of his scathing speeches in the European Parliament. Look them up if you want to laugh. Anyway, fortunately, I have an AI summary of our conversation for you. And once again, it recognized it as a thought-provoking discussion. Come on, AI. Can you think up some new words next time? Anyway, in this episode, Daniel reflects on the historical context of individualism and the evolution of political thought, particularly in light of recent global events such as the pandemic. The conversation dives deep into the challenges of preserving freedom in a society that often prioritizes safety over liberty. Daniel articulates the psychological impacts of collectivism experienced during lockdowns and the lasting effects on public consciousness. Listeners will gain insight into the complexities of political affiliations and the necessity for reform within the UK. We discuss the potential for a resurgence of liberty-minded principles and the role of American influence in shaping a more individualistic society. The episode culminates in an exploration of the future of governance and the enduring struggle for personal freedoms in the face of increasing state control. What would I add to that? I suppose I would just say that this was two Brits in the USA talking about liberty. And I suppose looking back over the pond and hypothesizing what the UK might need to start taking liberty more seriously. Hope you enjoy it, and many thanks to Daniel for sitting down with me. Nosta comments this week, and hey, did you see the news yesterday? Yeah, Trump signed an executive order creating the USA's strategic Bitcoin reserve. Oh well, alas, we here at the Free Cities podcast now no longer own more Bitcoin in our strategic Bitcoin reserve than the whole of the United States of America. But hey, it's still getting bigger each week. This week, many thanks to Formo, User 795, Aaron, User 230, Justin Bianchi, and Hypno for helping us swell our reserve. A few comments. Nadeshil says of episode 115 with Vera Kitchenova, great episode. Odessa is now on my travel list. Maybe you can organize another episode about the rebuild of Ukraine when the war is finally over. Hugs and admiration to you all. Yes, I suspect we could. I will ask Vera, see if she'll come back in. I'm sure she will. Bob John says of last week's show with Pavla Caron, episode 119, another banger. Thanks for bringing back this gem. Yes, Pavla is a gem. And she, if you're interested, she's been on three times over the last couple of years. And all of her episodes are super interesting. So go and have a listen. If you check the show notes of last week's show, you'll see the previous instances that she's been on. Don't forget, the Free Cities Conference has not only had its name changed to the Free Cities Conference from Liberty in Our Lifetime, but the dates have been announced 31st of October to the 2nd of November 2025 in the wonderful city of Prague. Again, you better start planning now, I would advise you. And while you're doing that and contemplating the proliferation of uplifting conversations you'll be having over a couple of Stara Brahmans in an ancient Czech tavern, well, why don't you just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Daniel Hannan. Firstly, what struck me sitting, I've never been to something like this before in the States. Mm. And sitting there, I was quite jealous actually of what was going on here, because we don't have something like this back at home. I've the room feels good. There's good people talking about good ideas. And yeah, it's pretty disappointing to think that there's nothing like that back in the UK. Am I wrong?
Like that at all in the UK, right? Let alone having one in every county. I mean, there is not a state in the US where you don't have some equivalent to this. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yes.
I mean, imagine if we were doing this in Sheffield and in Bath and in Brighton. I think it's partly just that Americans are, according to all the statistics, much more likely to join things. Much more likely to, your typical American is a member of many more campaigns, churches, political lobby groups, community organizations than your average Canadian, you know, let alone a European.
But I mean, even at a deeper level, talking about these kind of things, I know America's, I mean, it's in its DNA, freedom, liberty, this kind of stuff. But the fact that I was sat in a room full of really good people listening to someone talk about why liberty is important. That alone is something that I would never feel, even in the future at some point in the UK, would be happening. Am I being too pessimistic?
I think you may be slightly too pessimistic. I came here straight from the ARC conference in the Docklands, literally from one day to the next. And there were 4,000 people there talking about not just liberty, but conservatism more widely, rather like here. I think there is a real appetite for right of center ideas that are fully thought through and are not just, if you like, reactive. And I think that's partly because of the people have all seen the overreach of the other side with the extremes of woke and identity politics, and particularly the vast expansion of the state during lockdowns. And I think that there is quite a lot of of hunger among younger people to hear what the alternative is?
I must admit, I'm getting more positive. I found the whole pandemic very disappointing, really disappointing and I haven't almost sort of psychologically recovered from the fact that how few people really stood up against that. And I wonder whether maybe, I used to think maybe 12 years, 16 years in the future, there might be some kind of, a number of my friends now are talking about the next general election as being a massive turnaround, a la what's just happened here. Do you think that's true at all?
I think it's very likely, actually, yes. But we shouldn't be too surprised by what happened in the pandemic. I think I have the honour of having been the first Brit to go in print against the lockdown. It's a contested post, but I could see them coming. So any advances on the 20th of February 2020, right? Which makes me acutely aware of how unpopular that position was with everybody. My neighbours, my colleagues in journalism, my colleagues in politics. Even at the height of Brexit, I never attracted a tenth as much abuse as I did as an early lockdown sceptic. You're killing my granny, you're putting the economy before human lives, etc. And I think we should just recognise that most people prefer safety to freedom, and especially at times of high stress. We are triggered. You know, we're wired as a species to be hypersensitive to pathogens or to external threats. And the instincts that take over at a time of an external threat, you know, keep your kids close, be careful of strangers who may carry the virus, you know, hunker down. In a modern society, that translates into close the schools, close the airports, close the shops. And I think 2 years of that dreadful kind of collectivism has made a change that will last for decades in how people think. It's scarred us. And it's not just because it was all awful, right? I mean, the dreadful thing about these kind of collective moments is they have a good side to them in the sense that people feel a lot of purpose and neighborliness and community. And they remember that. It's like people who look back on the Blitz fondly, right? That's what they're looking back on. And it's much, much harder than it was than to explain that it's not up to the government to do all these things. You know, so rather like after the Second World War, I think we're stuck with this hunger for the smack of firm government for a long time to come.
Well, I must admit, I didn't see as much neighbourliness during the pandemic. I saw neighbours grassing up neighbours during the pandemic, people curtain twitching, you know. And so
yeah, that's not what I'm talking about. I mean, obviously, I hated all that as well as I hated every aspect of the lockdowns. I hated literally every from the insolent police to the debt. But when people look back and say it wasn't so bad, I think what they mean is not just that they were being paid to stay at home, although that's never an unpopular thing at the time. It was that, oh, we were all mucking in and doing the food collections and delivering stuff to the people who were self-isolating, and you know, which we were, at least. I mean, we were all doing that in my village. And people say, oh, you know, and it gave us this great sense. It's what people always say in war zones. It gave us this sense of shared purpose, that there were no strangers anymore. We were all like one family, because we're a tribal species, and we miss that kind of thing. But unfortunately, you know, there's nothing to stop people behaving like that now, right? I mean, this is what always maddens me about people who say, don't you miss the lockdown, right? Sure, of course I prefer playing with my kids to commuting. Who doesn't? But there is nothing now that stops you from saying, I'm going to make different life choices. I will forego a foreign holiday so as to have more time at home. And I don't mind earning less because I want to spend more time with the kids. Why do you have to impose your choices coercively on everybody else? That was the awful thing about the lockdown, right?
What you meant when you said people would prefer safety over freedom. Do you think that's inherent?
Yes.
No one's going to change that.
It's in human nature. It's not an original thought of mine. The Roman historian Sallust put it better than most people. Hardly anyone wants freedom. Most want only a just master. Right. And I think there's never been a time in human history when that wasn't the majority view.
So freedom, what should freedom-minded people do then?
We need to recognize that ours is a minority creed. we need to recognize that what we are arguing is counterintuitive. We evolved in kin groups. We evolved in something much more like a troop of chimpanzees than a modern advanced contract-based society. So we are wired to hierarchy, communism, and subordination before whoever the alpha male is. Never mind our fairy stories. Think of our science fiction. Think of Dune or Star Wars or Star Trek. It's all full of emperors and princesses, right? On some very deep genetic level, we're just wired for a basically hierarchical and autocratic society. And this is why I always think what we've achieved in the Anglosphere and a small number of related European democracies is extraordinary, because it's counterentropic. It holds out against all these human tendencies and has built something that elevates the individual, which is something really unnatural.
I mean, compare and contrast then the US and the UK in terms of individualism. My personal experience, I grew up in the UK, and I wouldn't say it was something that was, this is a Limey's view of America, obviously. America is the land of individuals, of freedom, of people that fight for their rights. I don't see that in the DNA of the British person, really. I think if you go back to the 40s and the 30s, maybe you might see...
Well, I think that's very significant, the way you phrase that, right? I think that is exactly when it changed. When people talk about culture, usually they're not looking hard enough at the incentives. Culture is not some numinous entity that hangs alongside us. It is a product of our institutions and a product of our history. I think the Anglosphere was marching fairly in step in a liberal direction, in a free market and personal liberty direction, an autonomy direction, which differentiated it from most of Europe and certainly from everywhere else until the Second World War. And I think the more statist tradition that started in Britain can be dated to 1940. It's unpatriotic to complain. Don't you know there's a war on? Have you done your bit? Obviously, our friends and allies and our kindred countries, who are our closest friends in the Anglosphere, were in the war from the beginning, but they were never subject to the full mobilization in the way that we were. And the relative freedom and indeed the lack of indebtedness with which Australia, Canada and New Zealand, let alone the US, emerged in 1945, I think, set the stage for something very different. There may be something deeper than that. There may be a kind of optimism bias in being ready to emigrate in the first place. And perhaps there's a genetic component to that. But in general, I think you don't need to look too far back to explain these things. I think most of the statist institutions that we had, some of which that we still have, particularly our healthcare and education systems, were products of mobilization. They came from the early 1940s.
So do we need another mobilization event, do you think, for something like that to reemerge?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid we've had another go at it with COVID, right? So if you look at how slow we were to come out of the wartime restrictions, we had identity cards until 1952. We had food rationing until 1954. We had full conscription until 1960. It turns out that the government is much slower to give back the powers that it has seized on a supposedly emergency basis. And when you look at the economic controls that were put in after 1940, I don't think we really got rid of them until the Thatcher reforms, exchange controls and this kind of thing, nationalizations. So we still had effectively a mobilized wartime economy in 1980. And as I say, when it comes to the NHS and when it comes to the structure of most of our state schools, we still do. Those were, again, products of wartime thinking. Just as we might have started to come out of it, we had like another 2 years of the equivalent of a war. Obviously, COVID wasn't as lethal as the war, but the restrictions in many ways were more onerous. At no time, even at the height of the Blitz, were people told that they couldn't open their own businesses, that they couldn't stay in their own houses if they lived somewhere else, that they couldn't, a second house, that they couldn't go to the pub or whatever. And I'm afraid, again, that has massively turbocharged all of the statism that it would in any country. I have a friend who emigrated, came here, my friend Douglas Carswell, who was a Conservative MP, then a UKIP MP, very involved with the Brexit movement. I remember he and I were watching a news story, a BBC news story, about an anti-lockdown protest in somewhere like Tennessee or Kentucky. And it was the kind of protest that the BBC love when they're reporting on America, because there were lots of MAGA hats, there were lots of overweight people with unusual facial hair configurations, and a lot of them were pretty kooky and sort of anti-vaxxy and all that. But I remember Douglas saying, I would rather live in a country where there is some reaction, even if it's these weirdos, than in a place where everyone is saying, please regulate me harder. And he was as good as his word. He's now in Jackson, Mississippi.
Fair enough. Why has the... even mentioning that, you know, during the war, no one was locked down. What happened to... Why is personal responsibility denigrated so hard now? Why in these situations is the instinct to go to, let us tell you what to do? Especially because we have a history of it. If you look back to, you know, the war years, there was a lot of, it wasn't denigrated back then at all. You know, how did it happen?
It's a very good question. I think it's always there, but I think we have acculturated people so that they rise above their tribal instincts. I think the desire for conformity and order is stronger in most people than the desire for freedom. The people listening to this podcast are exceptional. They are the wolf on the hill. And they know it. I mean, if they think back to their friends at school, we've always been unusual, those of us who believe in freedom as an absolute precept. But what you can do in an open society is teach people that freedom, although it may not come naturally to most people, produces better outcomes. It makes people richer, it makes people happier, and constraining your natural tendency to tell other people what to do is part of a trade-off that is worth making, because you're then allowed to do your thing and we get more experimentation, we get more progress, we get more enterprise, etc. I think that we used to teach that. When we talked about being a free country, we were consciously habituating our children to this idea. We believe in free speech, in free contract, in free association, and here's why we believe in those things. Here's why they work. And here's why they make us better than these benighted countries that haven't done that, or at least haven't done that yet, and we hope they'll catch up with us, kind of thing. And now we don't. We've reverted to a very collectivist way of communicating knowledge. We've reverted, particularly in classrooms, to the worst kinds of identity politics. We think of wokery as a university campus thing, but I think if they're not familiar with it, most of your listeners would be horrified to find how much of it there is in primary schools, let alone in secondary schools. Very young kids being taught about white privilege and whatnot. And you can't maintain a free society if people are defined by birth and caste and physiognomy.
Well, yeah, something that just sprung to mind. Isn't there a bit of a paradox here? You said one of the ways we can convince people is to literally show them that a free society is a richer, a better, a more productive society. And I agree with you. But isn't the problem that the people in charge aren't that productive? And that's the point. I think part of the attraction in joining the bureaucracy is that you don't need to compete in the free market. You get to make a rule on the free market. Is that something, do you think?
Sure, that is a problem. But that's intrinsic, right? There is no, you can limit the opportunities for rent seeking, but you'll never eliminate that kind of person. There is a certain, I mean, I've been a member of the House of Lords for 3 years. I'm surrounded by people who need subsidies as a fish needs water. They can't imagine a world without it. But I kind of feel that you can still convey to most people what's wrong with that and why that's a mistake. The difficulty we have is also the same as the opportunity we have. It's that a lot of our ideas are counterintuitive, and therefore they need to be taught. They're not things that people stumble to and work out on their own. For example, you know, the idea that you can lower tax rates but end up with more revenue, that requires a little bit of explanation. The idea that rent controls actually mean less property and therefore over time higher rents, that is counterintuitive. I mean, what do you mean if you control the rent? What do you mean the price goes up? Above all, the idea of comparative advantage, the idea that you can trade with a country that is more competitive than you across the board and it's still in your own interests as well as theirs, that is a very, very difficult idea for most people. And you can explain it, and with a little bit of time, you can carry people with you. And it's precisely the counterintuitive ideas that once people have seen them, they don't unsee them. But we are, I think, at a disadvantage in an age of TikTok, when attention spans are shrunk, when screen addiction is widespread, and when, did I read somewhere that the average amount of time spent on a TikTok video is 7 seconds? It's very difficult to advance those arguments. And that's why I think that the most successful libertarian or small government advocates today in politics are those like Javier Milei, who have mastered the idiom of the screen phone age. They've learned how to be shocking, vulgar, crude in order to get their point across in a way that that kind of audience is primed to hear. And the rest of us need to learn how to do that, I'm afraid.
I suppose it's a double-edged sword, really. I think my personal opinion on the age we're living through is this is the internet age. This is another sort of revolution on the scale of the printing press. This is the printing of information. This is speech across time, ideas being free. So I'm not as disappointed that there's 7 second attention spans on TikTok. I think sometimes that's what TikTok's for. But I know that but amongst everyone I know, long-form conversations are at an all-time high. And prior to that, we had a gate-kept media, which absolutely underestimated the potential of people to listen to ideas and digest them and want to go to the source and want to understand them. So I think
that the one is a reaction to the other. Time is now luxurious. I noticed that when the internet came in and everything seemed to speed up, that was when book clubs suddenly got going, when all of our wives suddenly started joining these book clubs. Because suddenly reading a book was a luxurious thing to do, because you were making yourself step away from the screen and take your time to do something and then talk about it with your friends. And I think the long-form conversation is the same. It's an indulgence that is all the more valued now, because we live in this age of instant gratification and screen addiction. Don't get me wrong, of course it is much better than having the gate-kept media and the dishonesty that was intrinsic in that. I just think we need to be aware of what the challenges are and how we manage them and how we steer a course. I've been quite persuaded by what Jonathan Haidt says about the impact of smartphone addiction on children. I think we can see that all around us. It has made us stupider. And nothing else quite fits the timeline. Something big happened in 2012 that made people angrier and more polarized and stupider. And nothing else quite make... And indeed more suicidal and prone to anxiety and depression. Of course, that is not an argument for banning smartphones. Of course it's not. They've done immense good. But we should be able to embrace the immense good while still looking at how do we mitigate the evils, right? Let me make a controversial transatlantic similar point. I own a gun in the UK. American listeners who think that that's not possible may be surprised. I am, however, more subject to regulation than I would be here. So in order to get a gun license, I have to prove that I'm keeping it in a safe place, that the key is somewhere else, that the ammunition and the gun are not stored together, etc. Now, I don't regard that as the most onerous thing. I've got a child in the house. Why would I want to take a risk anyway, right? It's a very, very basic thing. Whenever I make this argument in a state like this, where there are quite liberal laws, people always hear it as you're trying to take my gun away. Now, I'm not in favor of taking anyone's gun away, but surely it's possible to be liberal on the question in the correct sense, freedom-loving on the question of firearms, while still saying there should be some restrictions. Like, I find it bizarre that if you lose your firearms here, like if you just leave your gun on a restaurant table and walk out by mistake, that that doesn't prejudice your chance of getting a new one. I don't think that makes me a communist who wants to come into your house and take your gun away, right?
While I was listening to your talk, I'm going to pivot into something else here. Someone asked an interesting question, and I can't remember what the question was, but you ended up talking about China and the social credit system they have there and the ID, you know. And I've been an observer of this for a number of years, and I'm with you on that. I do see that as the biggest existential threat, and it is government scaling to indefinitely. You know, we had this limit on the size of government prior to the internet age, which was how many people can you get to enforce it.
Right.
Now we have the
it's unlimited. It's absolutely terrifying. You know, if you watch the news and you see those roadblocks in Xinjiang where the Uyghurs are being oppressed in various ways, I always used to think, why do they have checkpoints? What are they looking for? And then somebody explained it to me. What they're looking for is every Uyghur is required to have some spyware on his phone, like a mandatory app. And they're just making sure that you haven't got some whiz kid, you know, young nephew who's been able to take the app off your phone. What does that app do on your phone? What does it look for? Well, it monitors antisocial activity. What counts as antisocial activity? Growing a beard, talking to foreigners, observing Ramadan, accessing the wrong websites. If you do enough of that, you get automatically sentenced to one of these re-education camps without any human supervision at all. Now, if they can do that in Xinjiang, they can do it anywhere in China, and they can export it to any client regime. And that's what I mean when I say they are a civilizational threat. They're not just a country which doesn't like the West, like Syria or Iran or whatever. They have an alternative civilizational model which they are capable of exporting, and it's one that rests on surveillance, on a high-tech panopticon state with facial recognition technology, geolocation, etc., where there is no such thing as a private company. They've all been press-ganged into both monitoring and spying on and propagandizing for the government. And it's very hard to see, now that they're in this vice, how the Chinese people get out of it. And that it seems to me, is a real danger with the technological change that we're getting into. Every country is going to end up having central bank-backed digital currencies the way the Chinese have. I just don't see how we can stop that. How do we ensure that this doesn't allow future governments just to fine us automatically for saying the wrong thing on one of your podcasts that, you know, is broadcast and whoever's said the incorrect thing suddenly finds that 20% of their wealth has been taken. Do you know what I mean? It's a real challenge, and one that I think is underexplored.
Well, it's a very seductive system for a government because it allows the bureaucracy to run itself, essentially, which is, I mean, when you look at it, it's a phenomenally impressive idea because it does away with the legal system, really, when you think about it. In the end, if you follow that timeline forward, there's no need for laws. Sorry, there's need for laws. There's no need for lawyers, I mean.
There's no need for lawyers. And in fact, they've been getting rid of a lot of the lawyers in China. I mean, I was quite shocked when I looked at, and I didn't see this at the time, I'm as guilty as anyone. I didn't realize how rapidly and how vastly things changed when Xi Jinping took over. There was, in 2012, an emergent blogosphere in China. Independent investigators and journalists. There were limits. You couldn't write about Taiwan or about Tiananmen or about the Dalai Lama. But you could demand better prison conditions. You could complain about corruption. You could even ask for more democracy at local level. When Xi Jinping took over, that stopped almost overnight. He arrested one of the most popular bloggers, who then disappeared for weeks. And he then reappeared in this tearful, Stalin-type self-incriminating interview, accusing himself of all kinds of offences against the state. And very quickly, all the other bloggers shut up. They knew what might happen. And then the axe fell. The Supreme Court said, if you spread an unhelpful rumour online, if it's viewed more than 500 times or shared more than 50 times, you can get up to 3 years in a labor camp. And that was it. Bloggers all disappeared. Then the lawyers who defended the bloggers started disappearing. Then the lawyers who defended the lawyers started being arrested, and then everyone got the message. And it's, you know, I blush when I look at what I was writing in my columns as recently as 2016, saying, oh, you know, there's a power struggle in China, there are still reformers and so on. I'd completely missed how thoroughly this had happened. And I see this as a challenge that will determine whether our children grow up in freedom or whether they grow up in the kind of autocratic societies that were normal for the last 10,000 years until an eye blink ago.
I wonder whether there isn't... Everyone has a line in the sand, don't they? I know, and British people have... That line's quite a long way away, normally. We're very polite, we're very accommodating. But I do wonder whether, when you look at other communist-style systems...
Mm.
In the end, they've sort of collapsed under the weight of themselves. And it's normally people getting absolutely sick of what's going on. And, I think, obviously, China is ahead of the game here. And there's a lot of people there. And who knows what's going on there as well. It's not like we can read the local newspaper and find out.
Right.
So it could be absolutely anything. But you mentioned unhelpful rumours getting time. I've watched in Germany in the last few days, people, was it 60 Minutes? Or someone did a piece talking to some German lawyers. Is it a crime to do X, Y, Z?
Right.
And it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same.
It was what J.D. Vance was saying. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. It's pretty much the same thing. So, like, I would say it's an inevitability that we end up with this kind of digital system.
Yes. So Marxism is such an obviously useless system that it tends not to last. But I don't think the Chinese Communist Party is Marxist at all. It does, however, remain hideously Leninist. It is a great believer in the dictatorship of the party. And that, I think, is a very natural condition for human societies outside the West, and indeed in the West until very, very recently. If you look at any of the surviving Marxist-Leninist states, I mean, North Korea, say. North Korea would be immediately recognizable in its political structures to an Iron Age emperor. You have a guy on top with his family and his cronies, and they enjoy palaces and harems, and everyone else lives in penury. That was the normal pattern for all of our ancestors from the discovery of agriculture until about the 17th century, and later in most of the world. So this has always been my fear. I've always felt that the freedoms we take for granted are much more contingent and fragile than we realize. And when I see China with its social credit system, its automatic surveillance of people, and the willingness of the Chinese to put up with it. There's a wonderful book called You Have Been Harmonized by a China hand called Kai Strittmeier. And he reveals that there was a moment when some students from Peking University were in, I forget which one, I think UPenn or some Western university. And as an experiment, they sort of dangled in front of them when they were online were various links to websites that would have told them the truth about things which were censored in China. What really happened in Tiananmen Square? Who is this Dalai Lama figure? Why do people take him seriously? You know, what is the nature of Taiwan's claim? And they wouldn't click on it. So there were no sensors there. There were no firewalls. They knew that they were in the US, but they had been so brainwashed, a word of Chinese origin, by the way. They'd been so brainwashed into thinking that all of this was evil Western propaganda that they didn't need the constraint there anymore. And that's when I get nervous.
I think there's a, there's a very famous experiment with primates, isn't there? They have them in the cage. The top of the cage is electrified. They learn to not touch the top of the cage, and then they take away the top of the cage and they stay there. I think that's been the modus operandi for
10,000 years.
Yes.
For 10,000 years, Gilgamesh would have recognized it.
So you don't think that So you think the libertarian or the liberty-minded person has always been in the minority?
Yes.
And will always be in the minority. And so what do we, where do we position ourselves?
Well, so look at how, despite being in minorities, look at, if you like, where we've managed to persuade enough people of our way of doing things. And I think that happened overwhelmingly in English-speaking societies. First in England, and a little bit in Holland, and then it was taken further in the US. And I think that was a question of getting the institutions and the structures right. I think there are a number... as always, there's an element of luck in this. I wouldn't underestimate the importance of island geography. England, as the hegemonic power in Great Britain, and then especially as Great Britain, never really needed a standing army. Its defence rested on the navy. The navy is quite a poor instrument of internal repression. So when English and then British kings needed money, they couldn't tyrannise people in the way that they could if they'd had armed troops at their backs. They had to ask nicely through a parliament. But the real institutional advantage that I think England had and the rest of the Anglosphere then inherited was the common law, this amazing, miraculous system where the law does not come down from the government, but is the property of the population. And each case serves as the beginning of the next one. And it's a really extraordinary system if you stand back and think about it. If you were trying to design a legal system, you'd come up with something much more like the European civil law system or the Roman law system, Bonaparte system, right? You'd say, you write down the law and then you apply it to particular cases. You would not have one that grows like a coral in this completely unplanned and unregulated way. And yet that beautiful, miraculous accident has, I think, allowed us to develop a politically libertarian climate in a way that other places haven't. But like I say, all of this is really about teaching people things that don't come naturally. And when we stop doing that, as I fear we have, we see how quickly they disappear, as is happening here as well, by the way. You look at how quickly the US Republicans, in the last no more than 8 years, have gone from keep the state out of my way to weaponize the state against people on the left. You know, it happens very, very quickly when you flick the switch.
That is the internet age. That's the age we live in. And so how does that transpire in the UK, according to you? Like, are you optimistic about the situation in the UK? I know a lot of people checking out the UK.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I don't blame them. I just say that we've been here before, and we don't always know what's coming. My first memory of an external political event was the election of Margaret Thatcher in 1979, which I remember in very impressionistic terms. I was 7 and a half. I was way too interested in politics for a 7 and a half year old. But I can remember people talking about it at school. And I can just remember impressionistically, although not in detail, the period before that. So I don't really remember anything about the Callaghan government, but I do remember the despair, the way everyone used to talk. Oh, this country's gone to the dogs, I'm leaving. Nothing works anymore. Very, very similar to how people talk now. Now, nobody had the slightest idea in the late 70s that we were on the cusp of this extraordinary national revival, where we would go from being the slowest growing country in Europe in the 70s to being the fastest growing country in Europe in the 80s. So don't make the mistake of just assuming that current trends are going to persist. Things can change very suddenly. Argentina had 100 years of illiberal and populist government, and look at how suddenly that has changed. So anything is possible.
Hmm. What's your opinion on reform and the conservative, you know? I know that some people are being very vigorous about reform, and I think that's a good thing. But it's obviously at odds with the Conservative Party, isn't it? Because the way I see it, and this isn't necessarily a very well-educated version of it, but I see reform and the Conservatives versus everyone else. Mm. And everyone else at the moment seems to be doing very badly.
Yep.
And so there's a piece of the pie to be taken. And what's going to happen?
Well, I think that's a very good way of putting it. Reform and the Conservatives between them are 50% or more. And if they were not divided, they would have the next election all but locked down, which is an extraordinary thing less than a year after the last one. Hmm. However, we have a first-past-the-post voting system. And it is in the nature of that system that it badly punishes a split on either side of the spectrum. Just as Margaret Thatcher benefited from a split on the left between Labour and the SDP, so it's now working the other way around. And Labour's only hope is that the Tories and Reform are split in exactly the right proportions, as pretty much as they were last time, to allow Labour to win a whole bunch of seats with a small minority of the vote, which is very, very plausible. It happened in Canada when the Tories and the Reform Party were split there in the 90s and the early 2000s, and it could well happen again. Now, why, therefore, can the two parties not get together? Why can they not, at the very least, have a kind of non-aggression pact where they stand down in certain seats where one of them plainly doesn't have a chance? It's a very good question. In terms of policy, if you put the two manifestos together, in most areas, you'd struggle, actually, to guess which was which. The really big differences are on constitutional questions, like Reform is anti-House of Lords, in favour of a proportional voting system. But on the other things, by the next election, the Tories are, I'd have thought, absolutely certain to go into the election with a sort of anti-ECHR, anti-net zero platform. So what's the problem politically? The two parties are very geographically complementary. Although their manifestos are similar, their electorates are not. Reform is very strong in the north of England and in Wales, very weak in the south of England. So I looked at the figures here. Reform at the last election came second in 98 seats. Okay, let's assume those are their top targets. 89 of those seats are Labour held. 60 of them are in the north of England, 17 are in Wales. These are generally seats that the Tories either never won, have never held, or won only once in the exceptional circumstances of 2019 when they were against Corbyn. By contrast, in the patch I used to represent when I was in elected politics in the south of England, Reform was a poor fourth. These are not seats that they can win, but they did just well enough to put the Lib Dems in quite a few and Labour in some. So it should be an easy enough thing for the two parties to agree. And if we were all like Data from Star Trek, they would have done by now. If we were all logical, cold, calculating machines, we would have done the deal. That is not how human beings are. We have egos, we're subject to optimism bias, and local ambitions and rivalries. Now, this doesn't need to be decided yet. All sorts of things could happen. One party could plainly emerge as bigger than the other. But I would just caution, if there are any Tory or Reform people listening to this, I would caution against making decisions now, for example, on where you select your candidates, that will make it very hard to do a deal should we need to closer to the time.
Final point. You mentioned in either your speech or one of the questions that you see the cure for, well, I mean, you were talking about woke politics at the time, I think, but you know what I mean. This whole system, you see the cure coming out of the US because the US kind of started it and then exported it to us. What are you, give me a prediction then.
So what I meant when I said it all came out of the US, DEI and its various antecedents are largely a product of US higher education. The idea of elevating the sensitivities, real or imagined, of historically marginalized groups came out of the US. But such is the soft power of this country, and the power particularly of US drama, that the rest of the world began to think in American terms. When the demented summer of 2020 took place and the whole world was complaining about the murder of George Floyd, as though it had happened on their own streets, the other Anglosphere countries all
it's like they all wanted their own BLM movement, and they sometimes had to adapt it slightly to local conditions. So in Canada, it took the form of this lie about the death of children in the residential schools, which has now been utterly debunked. Although the Canadian media that went so big on it and caused all these churches to be vandalized and stuff have been very coy about reporting the debunking. In Australia, it took the form of the referendum on the Indigenous voice to Parliament. In New Zealand, it took the form of a new wrangle about the Treaty of Waitangi. In Britain, we just acted as though we were Mississippians. We really behaved as though Selma and segregation were our story and our original sin. And I will never forget the sight of a group of white British BLM protesters in the summer of 2020 in Downing Street shouting, or in just beyond the gates of Downing Street, shouting, "Hands up, don't shoot," at unarmed metropolitan coppers, right? We really do think we're Americans when it comes to these race issues. I mean, even down, by the way, to the fact that it was Black Lives Matter, as you know, Black people are not our big ethnic minority in the UK. Black people came to the UK as British subjects. They didn't even come as immigrants in the first place. They were already Brits. They came from the West Indies. Amazing statistic that I came across the other day. The first ship that came from the Caribbean, the Windrush, which has now been pressed into this kind of grievance narrative. Do you know what proportion of the men on the Windrush had served in uniform in the recent war?
Was it almost all of them?
100%.
Right.
Yeah. So the idea that this was, you know, this determination to see it all in kind of decolonized terms would have been unrecognizable to those guys who had, you know, volunteered. There was no conscription in the West Indies. They'd volunteered to serve and they were coming back to the country, which they just, most of them had been in the RAF on various ground crews. So why on earth have we convinced ourselves that somehow we are responsible for slavery and segregation, right? When we were the country that ended slavery, for goodness sake, and poured our blood and treasure into stamping it out, even diverting ships when we were in a life and death struggle with Napoleon, even then diverting ships to hunt down the slavers. And I can only come back to, we all think we're Americans when it comes to these racial questions. We've all watched too much West Wing. And which is why you hear in Britain these bizarre phrases like all white juries and separation of powers and, you know, things which just are meaningless in our context, right? If you're a white conservative, they call you a Klansman. If you're a black conservative, they call you an Uncle Tom. I mean, apart from being unbelievably rude, what the hell has any of that got to do with us? You know, and it, on one level, it's kind of funny and tragic. On another level, I remember at the height of all this, watching my son, who was then four, with a little black girl from his school who was the same age. And they were playing, and there was something on the news about these BLM riots. And I was thinking, if you're a black British child of that age, four or five, you can't understand any of this. You're just seeing it out of the corner of your eye. You're going to grow up thinking that the police are going to shoot at you because of how you look. I mean, has anyone thought of, if you were trying to cause anxiety and depression in people, give them a lifetime of mental health, this is how you do it, isn't it, right? From day one. But of course, because the whole BLM message was aimed at guilty white people and black people were treated as walk-on props without agency, no one was thinking about that. And it is the most tragic thing that we've imported all these problems. So that is all a lengthy way of saying if the infection came from the US, the antidote is going to come from the US. The US was first in and has been, or looks like being first out of this madness. And I hope that the same soft power and cultural reach that led to the grand awakening spreading to Australia, Canada, Britain, and the rest of the English-speaking world will mean that the antidote also spreads and we finally get cured and go back to being a society where we value people as individuals.
I'm going to leave it there, Daniel. Thank you very much.
Fantastic, Tim. Great pleasure.
That was a good way to end.
Perfect.